Hello, everyone, and welcome back to New Books in Biography. I'm Mark Clovis, your host for the channel. Today I'm talking with John Kukla about his new book about the revolutionary orator and leader Patrick Henry, entitled Patrick Henry, Champion of Liberty. John, welcome to the show.
Well, I'm glad to be here.
Oh, we're glad to have you here. I wonder if you could start us off by telling us something about yourself.
Sure. I grew up in Wisconsin a long time ago. And got interested, as it happens, got interested in both history and particularly Virginia history as an undergraduate in Wisconsin. Did my PhD at the University of Toronto, and after finishing the residency there, came to Virginia looking for work at a time when this was in the early 70s when, the universities were not hiring lots of folks in the humanities. And I stumbled into a research position that led me essentially to a career in libraries, archives, and museums has put bread on the table and given me a great deal of satisfaction over the past several decades. But all the while, I continued to do scholarship, publishing in the major journals and that sort of thing, and frankly exploiting my proximity to primary sources, because I'm just love to get immersed in the primary sources and hold the documents in my hand that were in the hands of the people that. That I'm trying to understand and to write about. So I've been in Virginia since 1973, with the exception of the 90s. I spent the 90s in the French Quarter in New Orleans running the Historic New Orleans Collection.
That familiarity with the archives comes through in your book, because I notice you talk about the record, or sometimes lack thereof, that we have about Patrick Henry.
Yeah.
And it seems that it makes the idea of doing a Patrick Henry biography a bit more challenging than with, say, George Washington or some of the other founding fathers. What led you to write this particular book?
I had been working, it's roughly 10 years ago. I had begun work on a very different book. I had begun work on a project in which I wanted to try to get a better understanding of the coming and the process of the American Revolution, particularly in Virginia, without getting involved in interstate rivalries and that sort of thing. Virginia's story has not been told, and it's an important component of the national story of the revolution. So I was basically working on that, and in the initial conversations between my agent and editor, we put forward a book that basically Henry would have figured in it, but it was a broader history. And what happened basically at that time, this was 10 years ago, is that I had determined that there was just really no point in writing yet another biography of Patrick Henry, because I didn't think there was much new to say. About 5 years into the project, my editor basically prompted me to rethink that premise. And what happened is he said, I think this would work. I think this would work well as a Cradle of the Grave biography. And I decided that in fact he was right. Two things in effect had changed. One is that by looking at the overall story and all of the participants and Henry's colleagues and this and that and so on, I had insights into Henry that would not have been the kinds of things that a biographer stumbles upon, because they're the kinds of insights that you see when you're looking at somebody in their interactions with other people in the group, if that makes sense. And then secondly, is that in fact I'd come across new stuff. I had you know, 5 years ago when we shifted gears toward a full biography, I knew I had a lot of fresh things to say, and I think the book reflects it. I should also mention in recent years there's been a really wonderful work by a guy named Kevin Hayes, who is in literature, kind of does literature and history. Kevin had done a study. In fact, I'd kind of prodded him into trying it. He'd done a study of Patrick Henry's, the documentation we have for Patrick Henry's library. And basically, Kevin was able to identify the books in Henry's library from the inventories that we had that were with his will, and was able to document a great deal more reading and reflection and that sort of thing than people had supposed in the past. So I like to think that between Kevin's work and mine, we're kind of turning a new leaf in the appreciation of a broader sense of who Henry was and what he was up to.
You spend a lot of your book reflecting on that intellectual development. It's interesting because you both fit it into the course of events, but you also describe his ideas and the genesis of his thinking on a lot of subjects over the course of his life. And you begin, of course, with his childhood. And it's interesting how you both talk about him in the context of colonial Virginia society, but you also describe how, to the best that we can, how he came to develop some of his early ideas for which he subsequently became so famous for advocating.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, I think there's, I suppose there'd be three major influences, if you will, on Henry. One, and the earliest, is his father, who was basically a graduate of the Scottish University of Aberdeen and had come over to Virginia sometime in the 1720s. So he was a college-educated man at a time when that was kind of a rarity in society. And clearly his father was Henry's principal tutor growing up. The second source of intellectual influence on Henry would have been from the contemporary Virginia political ideals and such, which a number of people have written about in our time, and in his day would have been accessible to him not only in his conversations with people, but also in a whole bunch of tracts and essays and pamphlets that were being written in the 1750s over various political issues. And there's a sense in which Henry takes these arguments, particularly over the Parsons Clause, which is a fairly complex legal case that involves the overriding important constitutional issue of it, has to do with the authority of the colonial legislature vis-a-vis Parliament and the King. Henry took a lot of the arguments that were being put forward by older Virginia statesmen, Richard Bland particularly, and Landon Carter, and basically mastered those and put them to use in his oratory and in his thinking. And the other influence that we have that is really significant on Henry is Samuel Davies, who was a Presbyterian evangelist in Hanover County when Henry was growing up, and his Henry's mother was attended his services rather than the Anglican services, and brought Henry with him. And among other things, in addition to some of the ideas that you know we can track back to Davies, clearly Davies is the main influence in terms of Henry's oratorical style and his his prowess as an orator. So you've got those sort of three, university training vis-a-vis his father, and then the kind of civic culture of 18th century Virginia, and then that overlay of the the remnants of the Great Awakening that represented in Samuel Davies.
And yet you don't. You also point out, when you're talking about Davies in particular, about how during the ride back from his services, his mother would essentially encourage him to critically dissect and examine the sermons from a variety of perspectives. So you also have this family influence as well, which you know shapes him in other ways as well.
Yeah. And in fact, you know, mentioning that, I think allows me to speak to one other aspect of writing about Henry, and that is, of course, that he's remembered particularly as an orator, and that's problematic in terms of a historian's sources, since there were no recordings and very 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 few actual transcripts of what it is that he said. You were just mentioning this situation, as we have it told to us from Henry's compatriots, of him riding back with his mother and being asked, basically, she would challenge him to recapitulate and reframe and explain the sermons that he'd just listened to. I really, really strongly believe that 18th century Americans in general probably had a greater capacity for listening and remembering what was said than we do today. Not because we may still have the native intelligence to be able to do it, but we've got such crutches in our day. We've got recordings and videotape and God knows what. We're not forced to listen as carefully and to kind of retain in memory all the things that I think an 18th century young man or literate person would retain in active memory. And it's partially that. Think for a minute, though, as evidence from my perspective here. Think for a minute when you're driving the car and you suddenly hear an oldie but goodie comes on the first few bars of the song, and all of a sudden, you know, your mind is taken back to where you first heard it, who you were with, and all the lyrics are there somewhere in our gray matter. We've got, you know, tons and tons and tons of pop song lyrics. I think that the 18th century, our compatriots would have used that capacity to remember things and think about them, and certainly actors have that capacity. I mean, you can do a whole Shakespeare play and from memory and so on. And it's that capacity for memory that I think informs the perspective of some of the people who did try to write down what it is that Henry said, if that makes any sense.
It does, and so does as well how they also captured their reaction. And I was thinking of, and I can't remember his name, the one person who heard his famous Give Me Liberty speech, and how his reaction is famous about how he wanted to be buried at the spot where you heard it. And how oftentimes that's what we capture. Another example I think of is in Benjamin Franklin's autobiography, when he describes the reaction he had to listening to George Whitefield. We may not know what Whitefield said on that particular day, but we know that it was so powerful that it swayed even a skeptic like Benjamin Franklin.
Yes, exactly. And Whitefield is a contemporary of Samuel Davies. As a matter of fact, when Whitefield was doing his tour of the colonies, he came through Virginia and actually preached in Hanover in the church that was run by Patrick Henry's namesake, Uncle Patrick Henry Sr. So those are all parts of the literate oral culture that that was typical of Anglo-American in the 18th century.
Now, from what we've been covering so far, it might seem as though Patrick Henry was being nurtured as a statesman. And yet, you, as you explain, his path towards becoming a statesman, a politician, was a little circuitous. You situate him early in this rural Virginia gentry, but you go on to describe how he doesn't initially set out to become a lawyer. He sets out and undertakes these other careers. And I was wondering if you could explain what it was, you know, both how well he did in those early careers and what led him to embrace this training as an attorney.
Yeah. He was coming, I mean, he's born in 1736. So in the 1750s, he's in his teenage years and trying to, you know, find his way in the world. His father attempts to set Henry and his elder brother, William, to set them up basically as with the store, as merchants. The difficulties that they face are two. One is that the 1750s are a period of agriculturally just a disaster for Virginia. On a couple of occasions, they have to pass the two penny acts that are in response to the crop failures in Virginia. By way of explanation, in Virginia in the 18th century, in almost all parts of the state, tobacco was the major staple crop, and tobacco was used as the means of collecting taxes and tithes for the church, and all that sort of thing were all levied in amounts of tobacco. So, for example, a clergyman's salary was essentially 1,600 pounds of tobacco. It's not like they were shelling out a wad full of paper every time a wad full of the weed every time they did a transaction. Most of this was done by essentially in book debts and accounting. But basically, tobacco was the mainstay of the 18th century Virginia economy. And what happened in the 1750s was that the crops just failed. So it was a difficult time for Henry to get started as a planter. And then it was also a very difficult time for him and his brother to get started as merchants. The other thing that was going on in terms of his merchant career is that Virginia in the 1740s and 50s was being overrun basically by Scottish, they called them factors, basically small storekeepers who were working, who had established stores throughout the colony at crossroads and the like, and were basically supported by and worked for big mercantile houses out of Edinburgh and particularly out of Glasgow. Those enterprises had deep pockets and plenty of credit, and credit was essential in 18th century Virginia because basically you had to run your debts on account until the harvest came in the fall and then settle things up. So what happens essentially is that Henry and his brother, in a time of agricultural sort of disaster or crisis, also fail as shopkeepers because they can't possibly offer their clients the extension of credit that and stay solvent that can be done by their competitors, who are basically hired employees of these Glasgow merchant houses. So he learns firsthand the difficulties of farming and of commerce, and then at some point, living as he did at this point in his life, right near the courthouse in Hanover, he decides to study law and go into the practice of law. The accounts vary as to how long he studied and such. But clearly, he read enough law to go to Williamsburg and be examined by the requisite authorities and get his license to practice law. And then that's where he really started to make some money as a frontier lawyer in the county courts.
You have this great anecdote in there where you describe his examination by Peyton Randolph, who at the time was the Attorney General of Virginia, and about how Randolph initially encounters him. And he is, on the one hand, a member of the middle gentry in Virginia, but because he's not in Williamsburg or one of the port towns, he has a bit of a rough appearance. And initially, Peyton Randolph dismisses him, and it's only after he begins examination that he begins to realize he was a little mistaken and that this is a very impressive person in front of him.
Yeah, and eventually in that examination, he was examined probably by three of the four people who were empowered to do that. And in that particular one, Henry apparently recounted that story to others of his friends in later years. But basically, he got the Attorney General Randolph finally basically said, you know, you've got some native genius. You've argued well. There's an awful lot of reading that you need to do, but you know, he signed the form and let him into the bar.
Now, as you describe, Virginia at that time, especially in the towns, was chock full of lawyers, and yet you describe that Henry has a fairly rapid rise to a pretty high status among the legal community in Virginia. I was wondering if you could explain how it was that he does that and the early case that really makes his reputation, not just legally, but politically.
Yeah. In terms of his law career, he basically practices in the county courts from 1761, I guess it is, until into the 1770s. And at that point, he becomes, it's about 72 or 73, I think it is, that he becomes one of the lawyers who practices in front of the general court, which is basically the Supreme Court of the colony. The way things worked before the revolution, at least, is that an attorney could practice either in the county courts, or a very small number of attorneys practiced in the essentially appellate things at the general court or the Supreme Court. And so Henry was one of about six or eight people who practiced before the general court on the eve of the revolution. And that's, you know, that's a high that was a high honor. Henry was, of course, famous for his skills in the courtroom, Jefferson, who was not a strong speaker, had a very faint voice, among other things. Jefferson was notorious or acclaimed for his ability with a pen and his ability to write briefs and that sort of thing. And Henry, you know, Henry had the oratorical skills, and immense effectiveness with a jury or with, or later with the legislature. The case that you're alluding to is argued in 1763, and it's called the Parsons Cause. Comes about in a complicated fashion, but essentially, because of all of those crop failures, the legislature of the colony had implemented a temporary rule that allowed debts, and particularly public debts that were normally payable in amounts of tobacco, to be paid in cash. And the reason was that the failures of the crops had so inflated the price of tobacco that the argument was made that this would be unfair. It was essentially a landfall for the office holders, who would suddenly be, getting being paid in tobacco that was sometimes three to six times its normal value, and that this was harmful to the taxpayers. So the among the office holders that were affected by this were the Anglican clergy, the clergy of the established church in the colony, and so basically they brought suit. A number of them brought suit, and were in the case of the Parsons Clause in Hanover, the Henry argued, basically in November of 1763, the vestry or church council had lost to the Reverend James Murray, who was suing them for back pay. On the ruling of the law, they determined that the vestry was needed to pay up the value of the tobacco. So it was at this point that, in front of the December 1763 hearing, that Henry was brought in. And basically what he was able to do was to argue that the vestry was responsible for making this payment, but it was up to the jury to discern how much the payment should be. On the face of it, strictly speaking, by the law, the payment ought to have been about £144, which was a substantial amount of money in those days. In the end, what Henry was able to do was argue that the jury should essentially nullify the earlier verdict, and basically he recommended that they could pay a farthing, and that's what they did, which farthing is what, half a penny. So it was perceived as being very much of a victory by the powers of the vestry, and also a vindication of the authority of the colony's assembly, the colony's legislature, to enact such a law for the good of the colony, even over the objection of imperial authorities. And so Henry was in making these arguments, basically he's advancing positions which, ironically, this is, as I say, this is the end of 1763. Within 2 years, these arguments about the relative constitutional authorities of the colonial legislature, the crown, and parliament, these arguments all of a sudden that had been all about church governance in Virginia suddenly are all applicable to the situation that the colonies find themselves in after the passage of the Stamp Act. And so that's part of the reason that both Henry and arguably Virginia take such a prominent role in the early opposition to the Stamp Act, is because essentially they've been primed for these arguments by this earlier controversy.
And as you describe in the book, by the time of the Stamp Act crisis, Henry has already made the transition, has already expanded from law into politics, and he's in.
Yeah, I mean, basically, what happens after this the Parsons Clause case, which wins him immense popularity, is at the very next opportunity, there's a by-election in Louisa County, which is where he's then living, and he's elected to the legislature. And as he arrives at the legislature in 1765, all of a sudden, as it happens, that's when Virginia gets word of the passage of the Stamp Act. And so Henry writes resolutions condemning the Stamp Act, and supports them with one of his famous speeches, the one in which he's supposed to have said, Caesar had his Brutus, Charles I had his Cromwell, George III, and then there were cries of treason in the legislative hall, and he's supposed to have ended the sentence, George III may profit by their example. So the success of the Parsons Clause leads to his election into Parliament. I mean, I'm sorry, not a Parliament, into the House of Burgesses, And then as soon as he gets through Osburgess's, all of a sudden the Stamp Act has hit the fan, and he's not only involved in local, but in what becomes international politics.
You describe his politics and his involvement in the growing tensions between the Virginia colony and the other colonies on the one hand, and Britain on the other. But you also spend some time talking about some of his other political views, which are of great importance to us today. And among them is his position on slavery. And as you explained, yes, his position on slavery is not what some people might think of it as being today.
Yes. One of the things that I'm, I guess, proud of in terms of the, what one of the things that I tried to accomplish in the book is that I've been able to document more about Henry's attitudes towards slavery throughout the course of his life than we knew in the past. And what has long been known is a letter that became quite famous, written in 1773, in which Henry is writing to a Quaker that he'd been in dialogue with for some time, writing about slavery. And basically Henry admits that he has slaves. Not only that, he admits that he owns slaves, but he says that he owns slaves of my own purchase. In other words, he doesn't take the position that some of the Tidewater aristocrats might have been said, which is, you know, basically there have been slaves in my family for three generations. I've inherited them. Henry admits that his complicity with slavery is that he has purchased slaves himself. He also in 1773 in that letter just condemns slavery as being completely unjustified, either in terms of philosophy or in religion. This is an interesting development. And so starting from that's what we knew about Henry and slavery, what I've basically tried to do is get at the attitudes that he grew up with, which we don't have anything, you know, we don't have boyhood jottings on this subject. But we do know what Samuel Davies and what his uncle, the Anglican minister, were preaching about slavery when Henry was growing up. And that position was basically that slavery in their view in the 1740s and early 50s was perfectly justified, according to them. I mean, it's in the Bible, right? And so basically the argument that Henry grew up with was that slavery is in the Bible. It's, you know, ordained by God. And it's a responsibility of a slaveholder to, you know, to teach his slaves to read so that they can read the Bible, bring them to Christianity and treat them decently. What happens in the course of the arguments that lead to the or the controversies and development of thought that leads to the revolution is that Henry comes to this position, as he expresses it in 1773, that slavery is morally and religiously it's wrong. It's wrong. It's an evil, and he is concerned, as many of his contemporaries are, Jefferson famously among them, for the way in which slavery is a drag on society, and then the way in which debases not only the people who are trapped in it, but also the slaveholders and so on. And Henry holds to that position, and I'm able then, with letters that I've been able to find at other collections that people didn't look at, basically, we're able to trace Henry's interactions with particularly Virginia Quakers about slavery into the 1790s, when he's no longer he still believes slavery is evil and repugnant, but he doesn't know how to get rid of it. He Henry does not embrace, as some of his contemporaries did, he does not embrace the idea of colonization, you know, that idea of that leads to the attempts in the antebellum period to establish Liberia and send slaves back to Africa. He doesn't see that as being efficacious. He continues to believe that slavery is repugnant and evil, but he can't figure out what to do with it, and therefore he ultimately comes down to saying it's evil, but all we can do is teach them to read the Bible, bring them to religion, and treat them well. What I like to say, and you know, I mean, we're often very harsh on people in earlier generations for failings that we think we would be able to surmount. What I think is significant about Henry and his generation is that in very many respects, they are the ones who were able to determine that and declare that slavery was an evil and pernicious thing in society. And so there's a sense in which we judge their failures by the standard that they set for us. What I think it's important to recognize that they were not saying, because it does happen later in the antebellum period, you do get Southerners who are arguing that slavery is a positive good, and you don't hear any of that kind of talk from Henry. Slavery is evil and repugnant.
That explanation of how his views evolved over the course of his life, I think, is one of the things that you do throughout the book, not just with slavery, but with his broader political views. I think that comes through very well in the second part of your book, when you talk about how he responds both to the decision to rise up against the English, to push for American independence, and how the experiences that he has during that period, both as a member of various conventions, as governor of Virginia during the American Revolution, and then afterward, how they shape both his response to the British and also his response to how Americans deal with their independence, which really seems to be the theme of the last decade and a half of his life.
Yeah. I mean, there's a chapter that opens with independence has been declared, the Constitution of Virginia has been adopted in 1776. Henry's been elected governor of Virginia, and then he takes ill, and he retreats to his home at Scotchtown in Hanover County that summer in order to basically get his health back. And two things, three people visit him. And I try to use that as a way of basically pointing out that all of a sudden the issues that confront Americans and that certainly confront Henry are all of a sudden changed now that they obviously still have to win the war in order to achieve independence, but they've at least declared it. They've written a constitution, and the three people that show up are two Baptist ministers who, among other things, are arguing to try to get the Commonwealth of Virginia to allow Baptist chaplains to accompany the troops. And essentially, there's a kind of it's an unspoken quid pro quo in which the Baptists enthusiastically come to the support of the revolution, in exchange for which the Virginians relax any of the religious sanctions against the dissenters. And so there's that kind of a sort of a deal that's made in 1776. And then throughout the next decade, the whole question of church-state relations is a very important one in Virginia. And then the other thing that happens is that George Rogers Clark comes in from the Ohio Valley and meets with Henry, and Henry is able to help arrange for some shipments of gunpowder and stuff, and begin his his work with Clark that takes Clark's activities throughout the rest of the revolution to basically get hold of the Ohio Valley and hold it for the Americans against the British coming down from Canada. So again, in these first weeks of his governorship, Henry is in addition to dealing with the new issues of church and state, he's also dealing with the relationship of Virginia to the western lands, the lands west of the Allegheny Mountains. And so these are, you know, these are a kind of a foretaste of issues to come. He's also the other thing that's going on, of course, during the 1776 through 1779, his first three terms as governor, is he's working very, very closely with George Washington to make sure that Washington's army, which includes a lot of guys from Virginia, has ammunition and shoes and blankets and beef and inoculations against smallpox and all of that sort of stuff. And it's really in those years that Washington and Henry forge a very strong relationship that lasts until both of them die in 1799.
And yet that relationship doesn't preclude them from having their differences. And one of the things that, where that really comes across most is in the debate over the ratification of the Constitution. And I thought that was an interesting, the way you present Henry's opposition to a lot of it. But at the same time, you note how the ways in which he disagreed with Jefferson and Madison about issues dealing with, say, Virginia's own constitution when it came to things like executive authority that were predicated upon his own experiences in government. Because by the time you get to the 1780s, he's been in various offices for two decades, and he really does have a good understanding of the practical needs of government. And he applies that to how, as you show, how he interprets these theoretical issues of the role of the executive, the power of the legislature, and so forth.
Yeah, I think that one of the things that that struck me in looking at this group of men interacting, one of the things that you can't help but notice in the 1780s is just how some idealistic may be how much of a theoretician James Madison is. He's relatively young at this end, and he's just caught up in ideas, and clearly shares a number of enthusiasms with Jefferson that frankly the rest of the Virginia political leadership, Henry included, simply find perplexing. One of them is that Jefferson and Madison both are just adamant in the belief that the Virginia Constitution of 1776 is somehow flawed, fundamentally flawed, because it was never taken to a vote of the a popular vote and ratified by popular vote. And so there's a amusing episode in which Madison basically tries to take a petition from Augusta County and turn it into a demand for some action on this constitutional hobby horse that Madison keeps getting, is almost obsessed with. Henry's position prevails, and ultimately, particularly in the works of Sir George Tucker and such, the Virginians all come to an agreement, and as I think is historically the case, that the Constitution of 1776, that the that the electors who sent people to the convention knew full well what they were doing and were demanding that they write a constitution, and they did, and that's what they wanted, and it's legitimate. But Jefferson goes on and on at great length about this in his notes on the state of Virginia, and you know, it was fun writing about this because I think on balance in the immediate context of the 1780s, Henry is shows himself to be somewhat more practical. It reflects too in the whole business of, you know, in Henry's tenure as governor in 1779, there are a couple of British invasions, and then of course Jefferson as governor in 1781 suffers invasions leading up to Cornwallis's invasion and then the eventual defeat and surrender at Yorktown. But the legislature of Virginia, while Jefferson is governor, the legislature gets chased out of Richmond, tries to meet in Charlottesville, which is essentially 60 miles west in the foothills of the Blue Ridge, and gets chased out of Charlottesville and has to scramble over the mountains to Stanton, Virginia. And reconvene there, and Henry's experience, you know, he basically recognizes that the difficulties and the powers of the governor are kind of inadequate to the emergency that the Commonwealth faced during the invasions, both that he experienced and also that Governor Jefferson experienced. One of the tragic results of this is that when the legislature reconvenes in Stanton after having been, you know, chased out of two places by the British Army, when they meet a kind of disgruntled legislator from Albemarle County named George Nicholas, makes a motion calling for essentially an inquiry on the part of the legislature into the conduct of the executive. Now, Jefferson takes this as a personal insult because he's the governor at the time. But in fact, and I think I pretty well demonstrate this with the fact that there are other members of the executive branch who feel that they too are being scrutinized by this by this inquiry, and yet Henry, I think we're not exactly sure because the records aren't all that clear. But the presumption is that Henry may have seconded this motion calling for an inquiry into the conduct of the executive, and it's at this point that Henry's experience and temperament and Jefferson's are just so in contrast. Jefferson, at this point in his life, is still pretty thin-skinned. Henry, on the other hand, has by this time been really accustomed to the rough and tumble of legislative politics, but having ridden the county court circuit as an attorney, he knows what it's like to argue against someone, another attorney, and then ride off together to the next courthouse and possibly share a bed that night at some ordinary somewhere, and then have to argue against him in the morning. And so he's much more at home with the kind of rough and tumble of politics. And basically, I'm persuaded, based on his own experience as governor, because nobody knew what Jefferson faced better than Henry, who had faced those things themselves. I think he expected to see Jefferson's responsibility, absolved of criticism by an inquiry. In fact, an inquiry would probably have supported strengthening the powers of the governor, which is something that Henry had advocated earlier. But what happens ultimately is, of course, is that Jefferson takes this as to be a personal insult, an affront to his service to the colony, and the friendship between Henry and Jefferson collapses at that point, and I can't determine. I've never been able to determine that they ever actually were in one another's presence after this. And so I think the animosity that Jefferson expresses toward Henry over the course of his much longer life, and Henry dies in 1799, Jefferson in 1826. So he's got a Jefferson has a number of years in which he's able to recall Henry and sort of get his digs in. But that animosity, I think, comes out of the invasion period, the end of the war, the inquiry into the conduct of the executive, and the fact that two men of such different temperaments basically misunderstood one another and had this falling out that was never healed.
Do you think that has affected Henry's historical reputation somewhat? Because reading the final chapters of your book, you had this impression of a man who's this elder statesman who is very sophisticated in his views. He sees that the Confederation is not working. He doesn't really like the Constitution, but at the same time, he isn't in favor of rejecting it outright. And then right in 1796, he's even being talked about as a potential president or vice president. He has a stature that by the 1780s and 1790s that we oftentimes, I think, overlook today when we say compare him to Jefferson, who obviously is president after Henry's death and then has that nearly 30 years in which to define his relationship with Henry and his historical and to have a say in Henry's historical reputation without any sort of rebuttal from Henry himself.
Yes, yeah, and Henry, I mean one of the things that that keeps Henry out of the pantheon of national heroes, I suppose, is the fact that that he, aside from his service in the First and Second Continental Congresses, he does not hold national office. He holds only Virginia office, and so he's not part of the Virginia dynasty of presidents that starts with Washington and Jefferson, Madison, Monroe, all those prominent national figures. And yet, as you're indicating, Henry was regarded as politically significant in the 1790s. Basically, what happens is, of course, Washington announces that he's only going to he's not going to serve a third term, and so all of a sudden they're facing an election, the way the Electoral College worked at that time is that basically the guy who gets the most votes is the president, the guy who gets the second most votes is the vice president. So that's what leads to the election of 1796, that's what leads to having Adams, who is arguably a Federalist, as these parties are developing, as president, and Jefferson, who is emerging as the Jeffersonian Republican leader, as vice president, and then it's only after it's only a few years later that an amendment to the Constitution is made to establish the provision for essentially political parties and tickets of vice president and president, but it's in that context of the election of 1796, where things are still under the old rules, that Henry finds himself finds his name being put forward by various people, and essentially he announces in a letter to the public that gets printed throughout the colonies that he does not wish to be considered for the presidency. He doesn't want to have his name used as a kind of a spoiler to steal votes from somebody else, and in that way distort the electoral process.
Well, we've taken up a lot of your time, but before we go, could you tell us what you're working on now?
Sure. I've just started a book on the Stamp Act Rebellion. At this point in 2017, the accepted great book on the Stamp Act is Edmund S. Morgan's Stamp Act Crisis, and it's a fine book, and it was published in 1953, and we've been using it ever since. And in the process of working on Henry, I've come to the realization that there's a good deal more scholarship on the Stamp Act that has been written, and that I've got some things to say, not only affirming some of the perspective that Edmund Morgan and his co-author and wife brought to it in 1953, but also some expanded significance of the ways in which the American experience with the Stamp Act not only defined political principles, which is what the Morgans famously established in their very important book, but it also, I think, established some procedures and techniques of revolution that the Americans learned how to do in the Stamp Act crisis, and that then they perfected and brought to bear 10 years later when they fought for independence. So that's what I'm going to be. That's what I'm starting to work on. Probably after we hang up.
Well, then I won't take another minute of your time. John Kukla, thank you very much.
Oh, it's been a pleasure.
And I hope you have a wonderful day.